What I'll do tonight is that I'll introduce Islam to you, and obviously with a lot of people out, I'll bounce back across it again. But this comes out of a history book, a copy here, a page out for you. It's a very simplistic summary statement of the rise of Islam. Now, first 300 years, persecution, illegal Christianity. Then around 325 is when Constantine, 315 is when he legalized Christianity, 325 is the Council of Nicaea. 400 is the fall of Rome, and that's when Augustine comes on the scene, and we talked about his influence in terms of the church for at least 1,000 years afterwards. So from 400 to 600, over the next 200 years, the most significant thing that happens in terms of church history is the rise of Islam. Now, you can call them Islamic, you can call them Muslims, Mohammedans. You can call them Mohammedans off of the founder's name, Mohammed. Muslim, the word Islam means to surrender, doesn't it? Something like that.
Submission to the
will of God. Okay. And Muslim means the submitted ones, I think is the way that goes, yes. But at any rate, Muhammad was a guy who steps up on the scene and says, I'm the new prophet of God, and he builds on the platform of Judaism and Christianity, okay, accepting most of the Old Testament, not all the prophets, but at least the law and the Pentateuch, all of that business there of the Old Testament, and he would accept the teachings of Jesus, only simply reduces Jesus' teaching to being that of a prophet. And now he's on the scene as a superior prophet. Just as much as Jesus says, the Old Testament is now fulfilled in me, and he gives his expression of what that means. Muhammad steps up and says, Jesus is a good prophet, good teacher, but I bring you the fullness. Now, what his movement is a reaction against Christianity and Judaism, not immediately with the sword, but reacting to the theology of Christianity and Judaism. The major wrestle he has with Christianity is what? Over the issue, what theological principle?
Monotheism.
The monotheism, the Trinity. Okay. And if you're looking at the handout under the prophet's call, going down in that first paragraph, Muhammad imposed five main obligations upon Muslim believers. First of all, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Prayer five times a day, charitable gifts, and they were a little bit better than they only required 1/40. I don't know where they came up with that number, but instead of a tenth for giving, it was 1/40. And in fasting in the month of Ramadan, and in a pilgrimage to Mecca once in your lifetime. Okay. So, yeah, it's that was the five principles of Islam. Now, as you see in the next paragraph, the basic source of the divine revelation was the Quran, and you'll see it sometimes spelled K-O-R-A-N, but Quran, I think, is the more appropriate spelling, and was collected and committed to writing by Uthman, the second leader after Muhammad. So Muhammad didn't really put the Quran together, but it's based on his teachings and that sort of thing. There is another portion of their literature called the Hadith. Those are the traditions, habits, and sayings of the prophet. and I don't know how to pronounce this next word. I've not heard it pronounced, but IJMA, the body of law of devout. Of course, you'll get the Sharia law and all of that that comes out of that. There are two main, reading on down, taken together, these three religious sources constitute the Sunnah or the path. A subsequent division with Islam between the Sunnites and the Shiites left the Sunnah in dispute. The schism was caused by the problem of choosing a successor to Muhammad. Okay, Muhammad gets things going, then once he dies, who's going to take over? There's a division in the camp of those who have joined around Muhammad about who ought to be the leader. And so we have this schism. Now, before Muhammad's death, he wasn't received with favor in Mecca and went to Medina, and then later comes back to 8 years after leaving Mecca, he returned in triumph. And now, a new world religion, under that paragraph, the Islamic community was now led by the caliphs, literally the successors. And, you know, in modern Islam, you have all kinds of different branches of Islam by these different caliphs, these different leaders and that sort of thing. Now, what I want to, now that's just a very, very simplistic overview. The major tenet of Islam is worship. And that's the reason the prayer is five times a day. And, giving of alms is, you know, consistent with Judaism as a show of piety. And, then the pilgrimage to Mecca. And now, everything that happened in the first six centuries of Christianity are needed to deal with the rise of Islam. Now, we've had many factions that arose within Christianity. Marcion, remember him, the guy who said, I like Jesus and the God of Jesus, but what? Not the God of the Old Testament. And so he wants to split Christianity off from the Old Testament and saying that the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament are not the same. What do you lose if you do that? Why can't you do that? Well, but he's saying the God of the Father of Jesus would still be that part of the Trinity. But he's just saying the God of the Old Testament is not the God that Jesus was referring to.
And all the prophecies leading up, he had Jesus proclaiming he was the fulfillment of those prophecies.
Right. He consciously saw himself as the fulfillment of the Old Testament. He did not distinguish that, you know, you all been worshiping the wrong God. Okay. So that's there. And the fulfillment of the sacrificial system that's, you know, taught through that whole system of the Old Testament, all of that. You can't break that. Well, see, they met with that. The Gnostics said, you know, yeah, we can be Christians. The body is, you know, here's the worldview. There's not just a God. They say there is a God, but there's also a lesser God, the Demiurge, who's the one who created matter. And we are the light of God entrapped in a physical body. And we got to get ourselves through knowledge released from that dilemma. And so they would still hold a worldview of a supreme God, but lesser gods, more a dualistic world, that sort of thing. Now, so lots of isms have come along and have tried to shift, twist, and do whatever to Christianity, take it off directions different than its origins. Now, here's a man who stepped up on the scene, and he says, you know, I want to get back to this in just a minute, okay? Well, let me reintroduce this. I did this last week. When Moses wrote the Pentateuch about 1225 BC, David, he comes in around 1,000. He was attributed to the Psalms. Isaiah was written around 750 BC. Jeremiah, the last of the 12 prophets, around 587. And then Malachi goes down to 400. Okay, so from 1225 to 400, about 800 years. And yet the Old Testament is not closed at that point. They're willing to receive more books. And in fact, it's not until 100 AD, actually the number is 90 AD at the Council of Jamnia, that the Jews decide the Old Testament is closed. We can't add any books. Okay. Now, so, that, over that period of time, the Old Testament was open for at least 1300 years. Okay. The New Testament, Mark and the writings of Paul start around 60s. The Revelation and John end up around 90. So you have at the most only 40 years of gathering books for the New Testament. And the declaration that it is closed. Okay. A lot of people say, yeah, that. Well, they did. Yes, they did. And when John was writing in Revelation, he says, I warn everyone who hears the word of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues described in this book. If anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will take away his share in the tree of life. Was John saying that the book is closed? New Testament is closed. Those words refer to his book. They don't refer to the New Testament. New Testament wasn't a collection when John wrote his letter. When he wrote the book of Revelation, he said nobody better add to the book. He's talking about adding to his book, not add to the Bible. Although, it's the last one we accept, in terms of dating. Okay. So we look at this and say, how come it was okay to keep it open for 1300 years? And yet over here, we only keep it open for 40 years. What do you think? In order to get a book in here, after you pass this stage right here, how do you get a book in? Okay.
No, in actuality, the Old Testament, really, there's only about an 800-year span of writings in there. I mean, it was open for 400 years.
From 400 down to Jesus and on out to 90, you know, the 490 years, nothing was added. But it was open. It wasn't declared to be closed. They were saying, because the Jews are, they're still looking for the Messiah. So can't close the book. Because the Messiah comes, he may want to write something, we're going to add it to it. Okay. Now, but once the city was destroyed and the nation was destroyed, they decided, you know, here we got, these Christians are using our Bible. These Christians are using our Old Testament, and yet they're adding, and they're saying no. You know, so anyhow. Alright. So, when Muhammad comes along, he declared himself to be what? I'm a new prophet, and not only a new prophet, but I'm a superior prophet. And there will be none after me. Okay, now, so why did they shut this down here? Okay. What?
He was the prophet. Jesus was the prophet.
Okay. Was there an expectation of there coming a later, superior revelation than what we have here? We have the self-revelation of God in the life and ministry of Jesus, right? Are we going to get any better than that? We're not expecting any more prophets. We're not, you know, Joel may think he is, but he ain't, you know, and then, you know, anybody else has come along the line. There's no one else that's going to bring us a superior revelation to what Jesus brought us. So what we have around, what we have in this, this real closed, quick book here, quick in terms of 400 verses, 1300 years, is that we have the words and teaching of Jesus, and it goes like this: what he said, what he did, and what it meant is what's contained in that section of books. So why doesn't someone like Muhammad, 600 years later, be able to say, I will tell you what it meant? Those who closed the New Testament did so around the idea, over here it is a prophet, over here it is what? You had to be a prophet over here. Who got a book in over here? I got it, Sean. Apostle. Someone connected to an apostle. Okay, either written by an apostle or a disciple of an apostle. Okay. Now, so what the New Testament, what we're saying in the New Testament is Jesus is a superior revelation. There's nothing going to come down the pike that's going to be able to say, I know God better. I have this new understanding of God. And you're going to say, and it supersedes God walking in the flesh among us. Okay? Now, what did it mean? We went back to those who spent 3 years around him and saying, okay, you know, Paul writes and he has an experience of Jesus. He lives in that time. And so if this had been still open, he could have got his book in, but Christianity says it's closed because you're calling yourself a prophet. And so you go back and you say, you remember Arius? The controversy around Arius, who said Jesus, there was a time when he was not. And Jesus is not. He's not the self-revelation of God. He's less than God. And so, if we had not fought that battle, we would have said, okay, we got room for somebody else on the scene. You know, the thing about Muhammad was he didn't say that Jesus was a bad guy. He said Jesus was a great, Jesus, he wouldn't use the word great. Jesus was a prophet. You ought to listen to him. He said many good things. But in the books about him, there's a lot of distortions and things that are not true. And yet, we know in the books about him that eyewitnesses were part of that witness. I mean, you know, you can't say Jesus didn't heal anybody if you got eyewitnesses that by the droves that were a part of this collection of writing, okay? And so they're not exaggerated. You know, the question of Jesus' deity is what's going to fly full in the face with Muhammad. Now, then Muhammad says, well, if you make Jesus deity, you attack all that Judaism ever stood for, which was monotheism. So if we had not dealt with Nicaea, if we had not dealt with Chalcedon, where we're fully God, fully man, you know, he is deity, he is not just, there wasn't a time when he was not. He's eternal. We went hammering through all of those things were in place to be able to embrace this guy here when he steps on the scene. You step on the scene, it says you don't get to add to the book because you know, Jesus was deity. Well, you know, you see how all of these concepts come in to play when Muhammad steps on the scene. And, you know, you know, one of the major distinctions between Christianity and Islam is Jesus taught a way of peace, and Islam teaches a way of violence. What does Jesus say to do with your enemies? Love them. What does Islam say to do with your enemies? Kill them. These, you know.
So that's why they would have to say that the writings about Jesus had a lot of things that weren't true.
Yes. Now, but if he's going to say Jesus is a prophet and Jesus taught a way of peace, he didn't know the right stuff. Okay? Now, understand that any time you speak about another religion, that is, in philosophy we talk about building the straw man. The straw man is a caricature of a person that's not real. Okay, when you say a Muslim believes this, or an Islamic person believes this, well, not all of them believe the same. Just like it'd be the same thing to say about it. What does a Christian believe? So you have to be careful when you do this. But there's not any question about once you follow the history of Islam. You get this thing from Gary Sheffield. You get an email from him recently on the origin of the word leather net from the Marine Corps. And get that. Right about the time of our own independence of this country, the Muslims were pirating the seas, and they would capture a ship and make you pay ransom to get it back. And England had a pretty good maritime organization until we rebelled against them. We were protected, but afterwards then we were not, and then we relied upon the French to help us out, and then finally we built our own naval power and started fighting against them. And they would wear leather collars around their neck because the Muslim weapon of choice is sword, and it will lop your head off. And so they wore these leather shrouds around their neck to keep them getting their heads cut off. And that's where the first Marines were called leathernecks, and that's where that term came from. But that was in the 1700s, but you go all the way back through, and the next one of the not in the next the next thing we're going to study. We'll come back, in 2 weeks, and I'll review a little bit of Islam with the folks and that are not here. And then the next major thing we're going to study is how the papacy, the Pope, the leader of the church at Rome, established himself in such a power of strength that the Pope rules the land, and the emperor bows to the Pope. And you see that rise. And then you're going to get into the Crusades. And see, the Crusades are fought against what group of people? Christian and Muslim. Okay, why do Christians and Muslims both want Jerusalem?
And the Jews. And the Jews also.
Yeah, three major religious groups. They all want Jerusalem. Why? Yeah.
Jesus was crucified in
the Christian
ministry for the Christians, and it's where Muhammad stepped off the rock to ascend to heaven.
See, they got the dome of the rock, there in Jerusalem right now. Okay. And so all groups wanted it, and all groups, after the teaching of Augustine, and the Pope rises to power, then there is such a thing as, getting into this way of violence. You compel these enemies of Christianity to release the Holy Land back to its rightful owners. Okay, we'll get into that at another point in time. Okay, now, all right. Okay, I want to be certain that you realize that within the teaching of the Quran and the Sharia law, and those were not penned by Muhammad, but developed, there is the foundation for radical Islam. Okay? Killing infidels is in their teaching. You know, it, just like the church in Catholicism says it's okay to torture people until they change their viewpoint of their faith, or like in the Crusades, you go and you kill the people who are you're opposed to. Alright. Now, just because within Christianity, Catholicism, they sanction those kind of actions doesn't mean that I, as a Christian, own that principle in my life. Okay, just like not every Muslim person believes in Sharia law or radical Islam and that sort of thing. Islam is as divided as Christianity. The only difference is in Christianity, we just separate. In Islam, they're going to kill each other. Because once we separate, then you're the infidel. And you go back to what we talked about last week. Augustine in North Africa met up with a group called the Donatists who said that once Constantine legalized Christianity, the church became partners with the world. And they were the pure church, the true church. Well, Islam right now, the factions are, we're the pure Islam. You know, it's the same argument. It's the same issue that you know, we face within Christianity. Is there a pure group? You know, and one group says, well, you know, y'all are not even, you know, it's like, among the Donatists, they would say that if you recanted your faith during the persecution, then you're not a Christian. You can't ever be one. That's it. Boom. So you're out. And in terms of Islam, they divide over who is the rightful. You know, it's been from 600 up to 2000 now. It's been 1400 years. And they're still not agreed on the line of succession. Okay, the Shiites and the Sunnis, you know, there was an immediate break. I mean, you're talking about the successor to Muhammad. They start down these paths. And then among the Shiites and Sunnis, they'll have multiple breaks as well. And so you've got all of, and that's the reason that, you know, you got Islams that are killing Islams. Because they don't believe they're the pure. You know, just like, you know, don't believe that you're Christians here. Okay. Now, okay. I don't want to get into a whole lot more because we've got a short crowd tonight because of the weather. And so I want to give you this and let you look at it and think about it. I really wanted to, you know, to me, this picture here and this one here is extremely important to realize that the words of a prophet are important, but when you have the self-revelation of God, you don't expect something else to come down the pike that's going to be superior to or add to in any fashion. And the question of the deity of Christ either makes Islam not viable or it does. And so that sets the stage for this. Christianity will wrestle with Islam, and yet they come out of the same roots. Christianity and Islam both come out of the roots of Judaism. You know, Islam recognizes Moses, recognizes Abraham, all of that heritage there. I think I'm correct that they don't recognize all of the prophets of the Old Testament, but I'm not a scholar on Islam. Okay. But what I wanted you to see tonight was in the birth of Islam, and Islam will become the dominant opposition to Christianity from here on. It's what you wrestle with. And it's coming to a head again. And Islam is going to own the world. And they're going to repopulate the world in terms of their tactic right now. They're content with waiting several generations to grow up an army within every nation that they're occupying right now. I read recently Europe is having a decline in Christianity, and there's a taxation that's going on in some of the churches in some of the European countries, and so they're just leaving their buildings, and Islam is occupying the buildings, and will soon dominate. I think even you read recently in England that there's a major Muslim population within England. We have cities within the United States, Detroit being one, that they project in 20 years will be more Islam than not. You not read that, Sean?
I've heard that story. I follow Detroit a lot. I don't know if that applies to the whole area.
Yeah. But the... And you know where... one of the, you know, where Islam does a lot of their evangelism, like recruiting people, jails and prisons. There may be people in prison who change their name, you know, and I can think, you know, if you got a way of violence, it might be a good place to go to get recruits, you know, go join the army. And of course, within Islam, this whole army and violence and warring business is promoted by the fact this is the holy martyrdom. You know, within Christianity, the first three centuries, being martyred by the faith, in the faith was the pinnacle of your faith. Well, they teach that, well, you get all the pleasures of the world in heaven. If you die in jihad. So, anyhow, all this comes together with the rise of Islam. The attractiveness of it, I don't know what major appeal it has other than they've kept the Quran for many, many centuries. They only allowed it to be written in Arabic. And so it kept a national identity with it. And it becomes the faith of our fathers, whether it's good or bad or true or right or wrong. You know, many people follow whatever they're in just because of their family heritage, not something they have personal conviction about, and that sort of thing. All right.
So it also seems to thrive on, you know, lack of education. Is not as attractive because I've got a good life now. And that's one of the things we run into in Christianity. Well, I'm pretty comfortable right now, so what do I care about the afterlife? I mean, you know, that, right. It's the same type thing, and that's why they recruit among the poor, destitute, and the happy. Recruit into radicalism and things like that.
Well, the same thing happens within when the papacy gets control. They keep the Bible in Latin. Don't let the people read it. We'll tell you what to believe. And you don't have any means of questioning or evaluating or knowing for yourself. You got a guy stand up there and says this. I mean, they do the mass in Latin. People can't understand it. Some kind of mysterious thing going on up there. All I know at some point, I go down there and get that wafer and I get that juice. And the guy tells me my sins are forgiven and I go my way. Well, they don't until the 1400s. I mean, my goodness, you go from 800 more years within Christianity, that people don't have the book. And on purpose. And anybody tried translating the language of the people so they could read and understand for themselves the words of Jesus? No, we're not going to let that happen. kill them and don't let them translate. And so you do control through ignorance. And you know, pretty laudable points of prayer and almsgiving and the pilgrimage to Mecca, those kind of things are not outlandish. They're just saying, and they're saying, here's a group of people, these Christians, that left their monotheism, went off into this polytheism, and we're pulling it back into what's true. And so we have to be able to talk our Trinity. We have to be able to deal with that. But if we don't have Trinity, then our book ought to be open, because Jesus wasn't the self-revelation of God. Okay? So we see how it all hinges, right? This church history isn't just history. It all hinges all the faith. And as we move from this point forward, people who don't have any foundation in the history of how Christianity has evolved and fought its battles and its wars, that sort of thing, they're going to give up. It doesn't matter. Just, you know, well, you got your truth, I got my truth, you can believe this, I believe that, and we'll all be happy. You know, I mean, it's scary because we don't understand from whence we've come in the battles that have been fought to secure the faith. Okay?